And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, live from a basement that I think is locked so my daughter cannot invade the basement and ruin this podcast, or make it probably actually make it better. And I'm excited to do this one because there's only like three types of podcasts right now. There are redraftable podcasts with everything. There are sports people with nothing to talk about, so they're having random celebrities on, guilty of that as well. And Michael Jordan podcast. But I ostensibly cover the NBA, and there's still NBA material to cover, most notably awards. And I wanted to start with perhaps the most obscure award, but one that fans get very passionate about. So to talk about all rookie teams, tentative all rookie choices, because we ain't having enough games if we get any to actually impact our choices here. So these are damn near almost final choices. And to have me help me do this, one of the people's favorite guests, one of my favorite guests from 538, Mr. Chris Herring. How are you, sir?
I'm holding up. I don't think I'm in a position to complain right now. I'm doing okay. How are you? How's everybody in your world?
Everyone's good, man. We're just hanging in, hunkered down, trying to obey all the rules and be safe and hope the governors of the states that we are in are not idiots. How about that? Anyway, let's move on to the all-rookie team. I like doing these. I like getting all the names in front of me. I like getting all sorts of stats in front of me and getting all nerdy and nerding out. I actually had kind of an easier time with the all-rookie teams than I usually do. Usually I get to like five guys, and after that I'm just like, all these dudes are interchangeable. Most of them were really bad because they're rookies, and rookies are bad. So I am going to start by saying I have – so you get 10 spots, 5 first team, 5 second team. I have 8 guys that I think are like stone cold locks. They have to be on the all rookie team in one way or another. And I have 4 guys who are first team locks. And then a 5th spot on the first team, that is sort of up for grabs. Why don't we get the obvious out of the way? Zion and Ja Morant are guys 1 and 2. I assume that because this is all rookie and not rookie of the year, and thus this is an award that is more just about who's outstanding, who kicks ass, that you're not worried about Zion's games, he's on the team.
Oh, no, absolutely. It's funny because you and I do enough podcasts to where we kind of go back and forth and, you know, put together lists and then compare and contrast. I was in the exact same spot where I had 4 guys that I considered to be no-brainers, basically for the first team, and then had 8 guys that I knew would be on one team or the other. And then those last 2-3 spots were, well, really the last 2 spots were tough, that I had like 6 people that I would have considered for. But yeah, those first 2 were the clearest locks, and then everything else required a little bit more research.
Yeah, I haven't decided if the season is essentially over. Like, by essentially, I mean if there are like a token number of regular season games, if any, that are not enough to alter the world, right? I haven't decided what I'm going to actually do for Rookie of the Year with regard to Zion, because with Embiid, that was an actual regular, real NBA season. I think he played 31 games. I just said, you can't win Rookie of the Year. I'm sorry that playing basketball is part of being a good basketball player. And so you can't win Rookie of the Year missing 50 games. And then I went to fill out my ballot, and I thought, well, he's so clearly the best guy that if I'm saying he can't win, then he just really shouldn't be on the ballot at all, because if he's going to be on the ballot, then he should just win. And so I left him off my top 3 entirely. I think I'll probably do the same thing with Zion, which is going to make the 3rd spot a little bit depressing. But I haven't totally decided. What should I do? What are you going to do?
I don't vote for stuff.
Well, don't chicken out. Just pretend that you vote.
Oh, I have to pretend. I got to at least lay the realities out there. It's tough, because the other thing that was different with Embiid's situation was that was a team that wasn't in contention. And so you could make the argument that Zion's games, even though he's playing a lot fewer of them, matter in a way that Embiid's really didn't. But now I think that that's undercut by the fact that we probably aren't going to, well, I don't know. Maybe there's stuff you're hearing differently that Woj is hearing differently. It doesn't seem like we're going to get many more regular season games, if we get any at all, depending on whether we go right to the playoffs, if there's a season at all. So I think that part of it is kind of tough to consider, but it is a weird elephant in the room to just kind of avoid entirely. I probably would put him on the ballot, because regardless of what you think, whether he's played enough games or not to be the Rookie of the Year, it really would have only been a 2-person race anyway. And so to just completely leave him off seems a little bit odd and counterproductive to me.
Yeah, the only question for me was if they had played out the season and somehow he wills the Pelicans into the playoffs, probably passing Ja Morant, I don't think he could have done almost anything to take Rookie of the Year from Ja Morant. It would have been more, does he get on my ballot as number two? Because Ja Morant's going to play essentially the whole season or most of the season and has been outstanding by rookie standards. He's been out by Rookie of the Year standards. He's been outstanding. And so this is not a situation where apologies to Malcolm Brogdon. He's a very good player, but it wasn't like he was a phenomenal rookie or something. He averaged like 8 points a game. It was a totally unremarkable season. Ja Morant was going to win Rookie of the Year. Zion could have worked his way onto the ballot. For some people, I think he would have won had that scenario unfolded with the Pelicans making the playoffs. That would not have been the case for me, I don't think. But anyway, they're both great. Ja and Zion, I can guess who your two other first team locks are, but why not? I will give you the honor. Who are your other first? I know who they should be, Chris Herring. So if you're going to be in trouble.
So if I'm just wrong if players. They're not the ones you picked, huh?
Obviously.
So you want me to name the rest of my first team, no, or you just, want me to name them one at a time?
You said you had four first team locks, right?
So I think the other two guys for me were Clark from Memphis and Kendrick Nunn from Miami.
We can continue the podcast because we are in agreement.
Okay.
I don't think anybody but hardcore fans realized how freaking good Brandon Clark was this year.
Man.
12 points a game and I don't have his rebounds per game in front of me, but 12 points a game doesn't sound like all that much, but he was competing for minutes with like actual really good NBA big men. Per 36 minutes, he was putting up 20 and 10. 62% from the field, 40% on threes, and I think even better than that on corner threes. Decent, you know, for a rookie big man, I think decent defender, can do a lot of things on offense. He was outstanding. And by the way, may have walked into the league with the best floater in the entire league.
Man, that dude's floater is amazing. I mean, I was sitting kind of watching clips last night of him, and it was funny because I kind of went in.
Wait a second. That's a sad statement. I know we're doing a podcast on all rookie team this year, but we're in quarantine, man. You need to be at night. You need to have a glass of wine and you need to be watching something that is not Brandon Clark's floater. That's a suggestion.
Zach, I'm working on a book about the 90s Knicks. The idea of watching modern basketball at times is really refreshing to me, given what I'm watching on a day-to-day basis. God bless the 90s Knicks. I'm obviously trying to sell a book on that at some point. But it is very nice to see people that have really creative offensive games when you're watching the era of basketball.
Do you have a title for the book yet? I can't remember.
It's a tentative title, Blood on the Hardwood, the Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks, which some people seem to like.
That's going to sell. That book is going to sell. People love the 90s Knicks. New Yorkers love the 90s Knicks to a degree that is – because of how inept the team has been for almost the entire time since that period, to a degree that is almost alarming. They love, like, it's almost worrisome about them. And they just were in so many marquee games and it's going to be great. So you were watching, please continue with your sad life of watching Brandon Clark.
That's not sad. I mean, I'll put it this way. I was watching clips of a lot of other players that are not going to be one of the 10 I picked for my all rookie team, which, you know, some of those moments were, well, they were all highlights for the most part. So they weren't sad, but, I mean, some of these guys were not, I mean, it's much easier to watch Brandon Clark highlights than it was for some other people. But yeah, the floater stands out as something that really sets him apart. When you just look at his statistics, you kind of imagine immediately that he's largely a floor spacing four, which obviously he can shoot, but he also is a hell of a role man and just kind of in the right position a lot of times with Ja. And it's interesting because you have Jaren Jackson is a big that you're going to obviously build around. It's just such a fun team. I mean, Memphis kind of came out of nowhere as just this extremely, extremely fun team. And you've got Brooks and you've got Jaren Jackson and you've got Ja. And you've got Brandon Clark. And so it's just this team now that I think, looking forward, he's going to be a big part of that. He should be a big part of that, assuming that this wasn't just some fluke year he had. But
I will say this. On my non-Zion Rookie of the Year ballot, Clark is going to come second, I think, ahead of Kendrick Nunn, who we're going to talk about in a minute. I mean, Clark was – Clark was overshadowed a little bit by Morant and by Jaren Jackson Jr. He was outstanding. Outstanding.
Really, really good season from him. I don't know. And a lot of people liked him coming into the draft, but I don't know. The rookie numbers like that are just really, really unusual. And, you know, whether he benefited a little bit from the fact that he wasn't counted upon to be a lead guy necessarily, maybe you could make that argument, but those sorts of numbers are really hard to put up in the sorts of.
Yeah, the only knock on him is strong, but the only thing to be perhaps not like over the moon excited about is that he's already 23 years old and was right. in college for a long time. What you just said is very interesting because with rookies, more than almost any other kind of player, it's very hard to parse how do you weigh being the eighth man on a good team, but doing it really, really well. And one of the candidates for my second team is essentially that player.
Versus, I know exactly who you're talking about already.
Versus being RJ Barrett and being maybe the single best ball handler on an awful team that is built as if the Knicks decided, let's sabotage RJ Barrett's rookie season completely to test his will and see how he, like, their roster is the exact opposite of any team should be built for RJ Barrett. And so some of his numbers, he has great raw counting stats or good raw counting stats, but his efficiency numbers are abysmal because he was trying to be a number two-ish option on a terrible team. So it's very hard to do that. So anyway, we agree on Clark. We agree on Nunn. Kendrick Nunn was just good, solid player, played a lot of minutes for a good team. I mean, there's not a lot to argue about, right?
Yeah, no, he was good. I mean, I think that they're probably he's such a pure scorer, and I mean, he obviously can move the ball a little bit as well. I think it's a little bit easier to pick out the flaws in his game. I don't think he's as complete a player as some of the other guys that we're talking about for those first two or three spots. But yeah, I mean, there's no question, I think, in another year, he would get Rookie of the Year votes for his scoring alone, really. And in other years, he probably would have won it on his scoring alone when some of the weaker Rookie of the Year classes we've had. But I think you look at that. I think based on what we're saying, it's weird to think about rewarding people for being part of a winning team, but also keeping in mind that maybe there's something harder about being a contributor to a winning team on a scale where you're averaging 14, 15 points a game. But he was that. And yeah, so
Kendrick averaged 15 and a half points a game as a full-time starter, 4 assists per 36 minutes, a 2-to-1 assist to turnover ratio. Decent defender, decent to good perimeter defender, I think can guard a couple of positions, 36% from three. Like he slowed down after his fiery start, which you knew was going to happen, but like never really cratered. Decent player. I don't see, a lot to argue with there, but, And I do think playing on a good team matters. And I thought a lot about this for All-Star too, because when you're on a good team, like the games are actually important. If you f*** up, like it, there are consequences. It matters. It hurts your team. It's not one of these situations where you're on a 20-win team. You can go out and do whatever you want. So you can put up numbers. You can have 9 turnovers in a game. You can do whatever you want, which is going to inflate your stats. But there's no consequence for being selfish, for being mistake prone. And playing on a good team, you don't get the same opportunities to handle the ball and do whatever you want. But it actually matters. You will lose minutes if you don't perform your job well. The games you are playing in, the outcome of them matters, and that just feels differently to players. That feels differently. It's a different environment. And so I do think it matters, and playing this sort of consequence-free ball is not the same thing as playing for a good team.
Based on what you're saying, though, and I agree with you, and it influenced how I went about making my decision for my fifth guy, which makes me really curious to see who you picked for your fifth first teamer, because I took that into account. I don't know if I always would, but I certainly did this time.
Well, like I said, I had 8 locks for the 10 spots. Mm-hmm. I penciled in one player for my last first team all rookie spot. And by the way, agents and teams really care about this. Like,
do they?
You would think all rookies, second team, nobody cares. I will get phone calls from GMs and agents being like, my guy averaged 5.5 points a game, but this is 15th in VORP and VIP and whatever.
Well, we had guys complaining about the All-Star, the rookie sophomore game and stuff like that too. So, I mean, it's been a
– The rookie sophomore – if my agent, even on my behalf, complained about my exclusion from the rookie sophomore game, I would fire my agent. I'd be like, dude, are you freaking kidding? It's the rookie do you know what's more, you know what's better than playing in the rookie sophomore game? Just going to All-Star and like drinking a beer in the stands while these other dudes play in this rookie sophomore game. Anyway, so I had one guy on my first team, all rookie, that I think I'm going to flip out upon further reflection for another guy. And I think, again, this is tentative. I haven't filled out my ballot yet. I don't even know if last night.
I'm curious to hear where you go with this.
I don't even know if and when we are getting ballots, but I think my fifth guy on my first team is going to be Eric Paschal.
Wow. Okay. Okay. So I flipped last night, and it ended up being tied to the winning team argument a little bit and the idea of being a key contributor to a winning team. I took Tyler Hero as my fifth guy.
He's one of my eight locks for the reason you just said. Yeah. What he did mattered. He mattered to a good team. I didn't have him first team because I thought he was horrible defensively. His 2-point percentage is terrible, but he's a legit sniper who mattered on a good team. So I have I don't have a quarrel with you, but make the case.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was the thought. I mean, this is a guy that creates offense for a good team. And off the bench is being asked to do that, pretty consistently, gets other guys involved. Like you said, a sniper, a guy that can create his own offense that, you know, really stands out in some nights. The defense was a concern and that it really probably not as, probably more so than with Nunn, which is why Nunn for me, not only the scoring average, but just the idea that he's a little bit more solid as an all-around player than Hero. But I thought Hero, like I said, I went back and forth. Paschal was someone I considered because his role was so different. He was like a lead guy for so much of the season for a bad team. And at times it kind of showed, I don't know. I'm interested to see how Paschal fits in with the larger scheme of what the Warriors are doing, but I don't think that should necessarily matter for something like this. But he was kind of a number one, at times maybe a number two guy for a bad team. And so I wondered how to kind of weigh that. And the guy I flipped last night that I actually had first team for a while, and I was like, was PJ Washington.
Me too. He was my flip out guy. He was my penciled in guy. And I was like, you know what, PJ Washington?
Right here.
Upon further reflection, PJ Washington, you had a very nice rookie season. Not as nice as I thought, actually.
That's exactly what I did last night. That was my calculation. But I really like PJ Washington. I just decided not to put him first team. I don't know.
He's on my second team.
Okay.
I think I was a little bit seduced by the malleability. It's been a long month, man. However the hell you say that word.
It's been a long decade.
Of his game. Because as a big who can be a threat from 3-point range and put the ball on the floor a little bit and score against guards on switches in the post, I like that part of his game. His resume actually isn't as impressive as you think it is when you dig in a little bit.
Yep.
The advanced stats are kind of a bloodbath on him, but he's solidly in the mix. But I like Eric Paschal. He played selfishly for the first 2 or 3 months of the season, and not just because the team was bad, but I also just think he was being a little selfish. I think he was looking for his shot a lot.
Right.
I think that normalized a little bit as the season went on. And really, as a scorer, 14 points a game per 30, which is neck and neck with a guy like Barrett, who people think of as a really high profile scorer. Per 36 minutes, he's a tick above Barrett in scoring. Assists, he's at like 2.83 a game, which is again right around some of these guys who are bigger name players, bigger name perimeter creators. And to me, 55% shooting on twos, given his shot diet, is really impressive and, you know, kind of a rugged defender, rebounder. His case was even stronger than I thought it was. So I'm going to swap him into first team, I think.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, honestly, what you said at the top there, I think a lot of us were watching the Warriors a ton at the beginning of the season to kind of see what is this team? What is this team going to be? It's obviously a team without Durant. Klay's not there. So I saw a ton of Pascal at the beginning of the season. And then obviously when Steph got hurt, you're like, well, how bad is this team going to be? Because they're already struggling before Steph got hurt. Pascal was the guy that kind of shouldered a lot of the offensive burden. And at times it looked like he was overburdening himself, playing a bit selfishly. You'd see him kind of take turnarounds and really, really tough contested shots that you normally watch like veteran players that have established themselves take. And so I think that kind of hurt him at times. And like you said, it balanced out over the course of the season. It wasn't really something that he was forcing as much. There was a little bit more of a rhythm to what he was doing. But he was a pretty decent all-around guy to the point where, again, I'm really curious to see. I don't know that you saw all that many things about the team this year where you're like, this guy is really going to translate nicely next year. I thought Alec Burks kind of showed things like that before they traded him. But I think, obviously, Pascal was the one guy that you're like, this guy has some real potential to do some damage when he's on a team that has more of the weapons there and available next year. And so I considered him briefly for first team. Like I said, PJ Washington was the guy I flipped on. Like you said, when you dig into his advanced numbers a little bit, it just didn't seem like the argument was as strong. But when I watched him play, it certainly felt like he was kind of deserving of first team. And I think you could still make an argument for him. It just isn't quite as strong.
You absolutely can. 46% shooting overall, 51 on twos, 37 from threes. Like I like PJ Washington. I think he was a really great draft pick for the Hornets. Totally reasonable first team choice. The Warriors next year are going to be really interesting because to the point, who's their starting five next year? I mean, it's obviously Steph, Klay, Draymond, and presumably Wiggins, because you don't really generally see guys making $30 million coming off the bench.
Right.
And that leaves a nominal five, and Pascal and Draymond are both sort of built like fire hydrants and can guard way above their size. I mean, Draymond obviously has been doing that for years. Pascal can do that, which opens up a lot of lineup combinations. Like, I think they fit very well together at the four and the five. I think each of them, with the other on the bench is a nice four fit with Marquese Chriss at the five. And the Warriors coaches love Marquese Chriss. And I think that's another fit.
Talking about this is depressing me because I'm thinking about Kevon Looney and just the situation that he's had, where like this was a guy that I was so excited about, had the issues in the finals, obviously trying to come back and everything. And now it's like, I feel like he's forgotten about, but I feel like it's because we don't know the depth of his injury. It's a scary thing to think about.
But it is, and he's a good player. I always thought that Kevon was maybe a hair overrated, like the Warriors pixie dust got sprinkled on him a little bit, like, oh, he's got a great IQ, he can switch a little bit, but he's solid, he does his job, he can pass it. His flirtation with becoming a long-range jump shooter this year was unattractive, but maybe it works, maybe it works going forward. But if you're going to start Wiggins and Draymond, even if your other two guys are Steph and Klay, if the third guy also is a bad 3-point shooter, then that becomes an interesting sort of jigsaw puzzle. And Smiley is not going to be, well, maybe he'll be ready, but I highly doubt it. And so they have some interesting, maybe Wiggins just becomes a better 3-point shooter on the shot diet that he's going to get, in Golden State. But look, they're going to have championship ambitions next year. Obviously they have their own pick, which is going to be very, very high. And who knows what they're going to do with that pick, if it becomes tradable or whatever. But I think they're an interesting team. But I like Eric Pascal, so he's on my team. So, okay, your first team is Zion, Ja, Clark, Nunn, Hero.
Yes.
And my first team tentatively is Zion, Ja, Clark, Nunn, Pascal. Process of elimination, we both have Hero on second team and Washington on second team, which leaves three spots left. And so I said I had eight locks. We've now named seven of them.
Right.
I had an eighth guy who played his way into lock status. Can you guess who it is?
You mentioned it earlier, and I could almost put money on it that it was Terrence Davis was the other guy you were mentioning before.
He's not a lock.
Okay.
Let's get to him later. And the reason he's not a lock is 1,000 minutes, which is the penalty for being on a very good team is you don't play very much. So he, I think he averaged what, 7 points a game or something this season.
Yeah.
Much better than that on a per minute basis, but still 7 points a game is 7 points a game. And the RJ Barretts of the world and even the Rui Hachimuras and the DeAndre Hunters of the world are going to say, well, wait a second. How does that guy get on over us? And I don't think that it's a totally unreasonable case for them to make. So I will talk about him later. He was not a lock for me. I will give you another guess as to my eighth lock.
Okay. So you want me to guess again who that other person was?
I want you to guess again. Yeah.
Oh boy, we're going to have a big disagreement here somewhere then.
It's a player that does not play a style I particularly enjoy, for the most part. But my hint is that in the last month.
No. I know who it was then. You don't even have to say anything more. It's Coby White was your next guy. Okay.
That's my eighth lock. Eighth lock.
Okay.
Coby White, in his last 15 games of the aborted season, 20 points, 5 assists on 37% shooting from three. Overall for the season, 39% overall, 43% on twos, 38% on threes. That's a little bit ugly. I think it's maybe 38%. Maybe I'm misreading my ugly notes here.
He was a fascinating case. I mean, I struggled. Now, he was a guy that I considered basically for my last spot. And I'm sure they're being here in Chicago.
Yeah, he's 30. He's 35% from three. I misread my notes.
Right. But, I mean, he was incredible. That end of the season for him, they had just put him into the starting lineup before all this stuff with the pandemic started. They were going to make him a starter. The reporters were kind of hounding Boylan a little bit and saying, like, are you going to start him? And Boylan said, no, I don't want to. He's playing too well off the bench. And then at a certain point, it's like, well, he's becoming basically their best scorer, and you have to do something about it. So I think he started all of one game, and then the pandemic kind of took the league by storm and shut everything down.
And there was buzz, like, are we going to see – is White Levine going to be the backcourt? Like, is that going to tilt Chicago's balance to the point where there's a little bit more playmaking on the floor? How much does that help Markkanen? And how much does that help Carter?
Right.
I just think his last month, like 35% from three doesn't sound like much, but he's taking off the dribble threes, contested threes, threes where you're like, dude, you may actually just want to not take that shot. Like, that's a little crazy. Whereas some of these other dudes are shooting less than that on threes that the defense is like, here you go. I might lay down on the floor if that's going to encourage you to take this shot. That's how much we disrespect your shooting. So, yeah.
So Chicago folks are going to be upset with me that I didn't put him on my team.
He's out of your team completely?
I don't have him on my team at all.
Wow.
And maybe it's that, he had a tendency, he broke it by the end of the season. It'll be interesting to see what happens in year two for him. This guy, I went and looked through his game log last night because I wanted to put him on my team because he was so incredible that last month. He had a tendency to kind of shoot them back into games that they seemed like they should be out of because nobody else was doing anything. I went through his game log and almost like clockwork, anytime he had a good game for the first two-thirds of the season, he'd have three or four games in a row that were really, really brutal after it. That's why his numbers look the way they do, despite having a month where he was just inferno the last month of the season. It was balanced out by the games that were just, he basically gave you nothing or was making 25-28% of his shots. Now they were tough shots and it was in an offense where nobody else could really get theirs aside from Levine a lot of the time. But I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be penalizing rookies for inconsistency, but I think that's what really hurts him. And what, on some level, when I think about what his ceiling might be, we don't know yet, but it, you know, he could end up being a microwave bench scorer for the majority of his career because he's so hot and cold. But when he's hot, he could be the best offensive player on the floor on either team.
Yeah. The Bulls are obviously really interesting for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is they just had a regime change that points to that portends perhaps other changes to their team. But White and Levine as a backcourt sounds enticing. They're both wired so deep in their souls as score first guys.
Yeah.
Levine is an average to below average passer for a guy that you want to be the number one option on your team. Coby White is a decent passer actually, but
yeah.
is so just tantalized by the bucket that I'm just not sure how that translates at the team level. And I wrote this last week. To me, the most interesting question about the Chicago Bulls is, two calendar years ago, I was infatuated with the Markkanen Carter front line. Yeah. They looked like two guys who were really nice fits on both ends of the floor. They have both individually and as a tandem completely stalled. Not, and obviously all these issues are intertwined. Not having a point guard who can get them the ball where they need it is a huge part of it. Whatever the coaching situation has been, has been a huge part of it. And that offense, I think, I'm curious what you think about this, because you think about these issues a lot. Jim Boylan all year said, our offense is fine. Look at our shot chart. We're getting great shots. We're getting lots of threes and lots of shots at the rim. And he's right. They are like, they have the shot chart of an elite offense. But when I watch them play, I never thought all that's missing here is shooting. Like the process is sound and all they need is finishers. Even if the shots that resulted are mathematically optimal, I actually don't think they're mathematically optimal once you drill down, because they never looked right to me. They never looked like good shots.
It's those two guys creating so much of that stuff, and it's not necessarily them setting somebody up to get them. It's Levine, you know, breaking down a defense, getting to the rim, taking a really, really, really tough shot. It's Kobe White stepping into a shot. It's him breaking down someone off the dribble. It's a really tough step back that someone's taking. Now, obviously, some of those shots are open. Markkanen did not shoot a very good percentage. Markkanen was not right physically this year. That's been another challenge with he and Carter, who, man, Wendell Carter, and some of the local writers here focused on it. This was a guy that shot the three ball pretty decently at Duke.
And yeah, it seemed like
his look at the basket.
Yeah, it seems like his job this year was do nothing. It seems like the coaches went to him and was like, you know what, we want you to do an offense? Nothing. How still can you stand? Can you go scout the Jordan statue outside the United Center and try to pick up some tips from that? It's like, this guy's supposed to be good.
It's hard to think about that offense working optimally when you've got him standing still, setting screens, you know, maybe touching the ball by accident sometimes. He's too talented. He was too talented in college to play that role. And you can't afford to have him doing that when Markkanen's not playing efficiently, when he's not knocking down shots, when he's not right physically. So it's weird to think that their backcourt in some ways might be set. I don't know that I'm sold enough on their defense if that ends up being their backcourt with White.
I think a White Levine backcourt may be problematic defensively.
A little.
And Otto Porter Jr. is like, is he ever going to play 40 games in a season again? Like, what in the hell is going on there? I don't think I can ever recall an offense where I was convinced less by the shot chart. I just never bought it. I never bought it when Jim would say it at press conferences. I see it. I see the math. And then I see where they're getting shots from. And then I watch the games and I'm like, there's something gummy. It's not working. I don't care that the shot locations are what they are. It's a bad offense. It was a bad offense. It just wasn't good. So I still have high hopes for Markkanen and Carter. I hope that whatever ecosystem they have there brings what those guys have in them out of them, because those guys are good. And boy, it's right now they have the feel of players that other teams are going to get in 3 years and be like, okay, let's resurrect this guy.
It sounds like there'd be a lot of interest in Markkanen if the Bulls. Now I think with a new regime coming in, they're more likely to figure out how to make it work with him. He's too young. He has a skill set that seems conducive to getting a lot out of. But between him and Carter, I mean, Carter, he's a good passer, can rebound, he's a good defender.
He was, for portions of the season, this is going to sound crazy, I think he might have been their best player for like a month here.
It's not a crazy argument. And they weren't doing any, like everything he was getting scoring-wise, opportunity-wise, was through his own means, which that's just a really, that's why, and you know, obviously, I work at 538, I'm a numbers person, but that's why it's hard to just look at the shot chart and say, this is working the way it should. We're getting what we should out of this offense. It was very clear that they weren't. And I think that Carter was a good example of that.
I think this is an obvious one, but I'm fascinated to see what Arturas does with Zach LaVine. And if and when we start to hear Zach LaVine trade rumors and the Bulls are looking into it, because I think it would be a smart bit of due diligence at the very least on their part to just see, you know, is this a way we can pivot? But I mean, you remember what they got for Jimmy Butler is, I mean, I don't know if Chris Dunn's on the team next year. I thought he might make an all defense team this year. He was just hellacious on that end, but he's so bad offensively that who knows. LaVine, Markkanen, and that they traded up for. And very intentionally, part of the Jimmy Butler trade was let's be super bad in the subsequent year. And that netted them Wendell Carter Jr. They got to get more out of that, because Jimmy Butler, when they pivoted away from him, someone is going to look back and write a good anniversary story on that trade, because it happened at the draft and so many crazy things were happening that we all sort of moved on fast. Jimmy Butler was 27 going on 28. I understand he's a personality that was not a good fit really in a lot of different places. Is he worth the supermax that he might have been getting? Probably not. Part of the problem with the supermax is that almost no players are worth it. Damian Lillard is not going to be worth it when he's making $50 million a year on a whatever cap or whatever it ends up being. And I love Damian Lillard. I have him fourth on my MVP ballot. So the Portland people, do not come at me that I'm doing Damian Lillard slander. Save it. Focus on your families. Don't come at me. It's just a hard cut, but like Jimmy Butler's really good. And there were knee issues and leg issues and rumors of this and that. He's really good. They had all their own draft picks. They had cap space. They had Mirotić. They had Butler. They had some other stuff. And they just didn't want any part of it. They bailed out of it early. And they got all this stuff. And their argument was, hey, look, we don't think we can ever win a championship with Jimmy Butler as a supermax and the cap space and this and that. We think we have a better chance to win a championship. If you're setting championship as the goal, we think we have a better chance bailing out and getting all this other young stuff. That gives us better championship odds. You know what? They're probably right in theory that getting all this other stuff gives us a better chance at getting a 22-year-old who pops and another 22-year-old who pops. And then we got something. But the problem is they got a pop. Jimmy Butler was already pre-popped. Jimmy Butler was already a top 10, 12 player in the league. He's the kind of player that you tank for. And in the hard truth is that both of those paths, the Butler path and the path they're currently on, probably top out it. If things go well, probably reasonably, like the most common outcome is the most common good outcome, that the percentile 50 to 75 outcome or 50 to 80
45
is like
wins, maybe.
Yeah. It's like a good team, like 52 wins, 55 wins. Never really does anything in the playoffs, but like has fun, gets a couple second round appearances. And so to me, that franchise pivot is really, really interesting. And in 2 years or 3 years, when everyone associated with it is willing to talk, that's a really interesting story, because that's not we're a bad team and our star is 32. That's where what we are and our star is 27, and they bailed out of it and they have not gotten enough return yet. There is still time. I'm a Markkanen believer. I'm a Carter believer. I'm a bit of a LaVine skeptic. But it was a fascinating, I mean, you're in Chicago. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens.
No, you're absolutely right with the idea of, you know, the idea that Butler, maybe you weren't going to win it all with Butler and a cast of other guys that you can find. But at the same time, I think when they dealt him away, like you said, the thought was that they were going to be awful. And they haven't ever been awful enough to really justify the thought of them being a contender anytime soon. They've never ended up with a number one pick, a number two pick, number three pick. They've gotten number seven. I want to say Markkanen was the seventh pick. Wendell Carter was a seventh pick. And really this season, who knows where they end up, but they're probably not going to end up top three, top four this year either. Because this was a team that people thought, now you and I didn't think this at the beginning of the season, but this is a team that some people thought could contend for the playoffs, and ends up being a team that I think maybe had one win over a team that was 500 or better. And that's just not good enough. So you have to hope that, you know, assuming that, Arturas comes in and probably changes the coach, that he can get more out of Carter and Markkanen, especially if you don't think that they're playing to their potential, that maybe a coaching change, maybe a style of play change helps with that and gets more out of them.
The interesting thing about coaching changes, because this would seem to be, I think, an obvious candidate for one, anytime there's a new front office. Although the counter thought to that is, do you want to play that card right away? Because you only get to play that card so many times as the GM or the president. But this would seem to be a case to watch anyway. One of the things in talking to agents in that space is the financial uncertainty right now is no one really knows what effect that will have on coaching and front office movement, or how much it might limit coaching and front office movement, because a lot of these owners, it's going to be a bit of a harder sell to them to say, okay, why don't you eat X million dollars over 2 years because we need to get rid of this coach and you got to pay this new coach. And I think, you know, there is concern is the wrong word. There is curiosity among agents in the coaching field that, those kind of financial uncertainties related to the coronavirus are going to sort of maybe more guys by just inertia will keep their job. Anyway, that's the Bulls. So far I have named my eight locks are all out there. Zion, Ja, Brandon Clark, Pascal, Washington, Nunn, Kobe White, Tyler Hero. That's eight. I have two spots left. It sounds like, we both have Terrence Davis on our all rookie team.
Right.
I wouldn't consider him a lock, but he's going to make my team. So he's my ninth guy. Again, only fewer than 1100 minutes played, 7.7 points a game. Some games where he just wouldn't play much at all. The rare times where the Raptors were fully healthy, which is almost never, he was sort of on the fringes. So I can make the case, but since you have him, I'm curious. Make the case why he should be, why he belongs over, and we could name seven guys from Darius Garland to RJ Barrett to DeAndre Hunter and blah, 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 who played 600, 700, 800 more minutes than him and sure. had to do more stuff than him because their teams are bad.
Sure. So, you know, I think Terrence Davis is an interesting pick because I think he and Clark, I'll put it this way, and this is through a 538 lens, but you put it this way. There were only two guys, rookies who played significant minutes, meaning I think something like 900 or more, who were a net positive in our Raptor statistics. So it kind of takes into account,
well, that's just rigged because it's called Raptor. So do you have a Raptor? I assume you have like a 5% Raptor kicker built into the.
Probably. I'd have to ask Nate Silver, my boss. I didn't even think about that. But yeah, I mean, basically it rated him and it rated Brandon Clark as the lone two rookies who had significant minutes who were a positive on both sides of the ball. Which I think that's part of the reason he was a difference maker and part of the reason that kind of in that team specifically, those are guys that kind of do a little bit of everything that fits well regardless of what lineup you put him with, who did really well in moments where he got more playing time. But like you said, I did think it was really interesting that I took a look. I was analyzing this so closely in some cases. I was looking at clutch statistics for the rookies. And some of their advanced numbers. And it was really interesting because Terrence Davis falls off a cliff in that stat just because he doesn't have clutch minutes compared to like Brandon Clark was incredible in his clutch minutes as far as how he was shooting and stuff like that. Terrence Davis doesn't have many of them because aside from when the Raptors were really banged up, which frankly was a lot of the time, he just doesn't have that to show. But I just think his kind of all around game was really nice. I thought you could kind of plug him in he played with several different lineups. And they consistently played well while he was out there. So no, he wasn't getting an opportunity to be out there all the time. And when he was, it wasn't for long minutes, but pretty good spot up guy, a guy that could put the ball on the floor. You know, a guy that could punish you if you came out too hard on him in a closeout, could throw a floater up over you. Good defender and someone that really, when I look at the Raptors and the way that they've played the last few years, wouldn't surprise me if he's a much bigger part of the rotation in a couple of years. If they lose somebody in free agency or something like that, and he gets an opportunity to step up even more. It just kind of seems like these are the sorts of guys that the Raptors churn out. And so does he get credit for that? No, he probably shouldn't. But again, the idea of him being a contributor on a winning team, this might be kind of my second team version of Tyler Hero with better advanced statistics than other guys that I would have been comparing for that spot. And so I really like Terrence Davis.
Terrence Davis was a good two-way player on a good team. And that is a rare thing to say about a rookie. You know, a good two-way player, a very good defensive player, 55% on twos, 40% on threes, 60% true shooting, which is fifth among rookies. again, 7.7 points a game per 36 minutes, 16.5, which is neck and neck with your Barretts and your other guys who are averaging a ton of points. 7.5 rebounds per 36 minutes with his eighth among rookies ahead of some big men. He's a hellacious rebounder, a really good cutter who just fit in on both ends of the floor and took nothing from the table, to use a Simmonsism, on a good team. And just one of those guys who gets thrown into an NBA game, and the minute you see his body and his physicality and the way he plays, you just think, well, how did nobody want this guy in the draft? Like, this guy's an NBA player. He's a very obvious NBA player.
Toronto specialty.
So 1,100 minutes or whatever, didn't have the offensive burden that some of those other guys did. I get the argument against him, but I thought he was a really good player on a really good team and was an important part of their team. And those numbers, those are really impressive numbers. So he's in for me.
Scaring me a little bit because I can't tell, but I'm guessing from the tone of the way you treated his candidacy, even though you picked him, that one of the guys I have on my team you probably don't have.
Yeah, so since you don't have Coby White, I think I've revealed 9 of my 10, and my 10th spot is a little bit in flux. I really don't know who I'm going to pick. But I believe we have 2 of your names left. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have to, based on what we've said. So
give me the one that you think I'm not going to like.
Okay. The one I don't think you're going to like, and maybe I'm wrong, because I think we'll both agree on at least one part of him. Matisse Thybulle was a guy that had lesser numbers even than Terrence Davis, obviously. He's not a huge offensive player. Probably will end up being, if he does make an all-rookie team, will be the lowest scoring all-rookie that we've probably seen. I don't know if ever, but definitely in recent memory, if not ever. Less than 5 points a game. Someone who was injured for a little bit, but I think we can all agree is, if not the best defensive rookie, and someone that, you know, I think in another year or so will probably be, you know, an all-defensive pick if he gets the minutes to do it. I think that he was efficient enough when he actually did shoot. I think that he was on a team that is going to be in the playoffs if we continue the season. He was a contributor to that team. He was a difference maker in the minutes that he got. And he was hands down the best defender of all the rookies that we're looking at. Basically one of the league leaders in deflections despite the minutes that he was getting. So I put him on my team, but I could imagine that based on what you're saying about Davis and the lack of statistics from him, that maybe you didn't put Thybulle on your team.
I love Matisse Thybulle. I love watching him play. He's the best rookie defender on the wing that I think I've ever seen. I'm not even sure Kawhi was this good as a rookie coming into the league. I thought and have continued to think about putting him in the 10th spot. Everything I just said to about Terrence Davis to some degree applies here. He's fifth in value over a replacement player. The advanced stats love him. Fifth among rookies. He belongs in the discussion. For me, I don't know where the line is. I don't know where the threshold is. But the threshold of, is he doing enough on offense? Yeah, he came in below it to me.
Okay.
At four points and change. And essentially just like kind of don't dribble, like just please don't dribble.
That's exactly what it looked like.
And the Sixers will shoot back to me like, yeah, but defense is half the game. And he's already elite at that on a good team. I get it. I just think he's maybe 11th or 12th on my ballot right now.
Sure.
So he's close, but wherever that line is, I just think he didn't quite do enough offensively through no fault. Well, through some fault of his own, I guess, but, don't have a lot of problems with it, but he didn't make my team. So now we've both revealed 9.
Okay. Man, he was my 9th pick. So I struggled more with 10, but then within that, I had like 5 guys that I wanted to put in the 10th spot. Coby White was one that I considered, and looked at for a long time. And then there were probably 3-4 other guys that I wanted to consider. Also considering, like, should I take more than one guy from one team, from a single team, which I obviously did in a couple cases, between Memphis and Miami. So I'm curious to hear who your 10th guy was, or do you want me to reveal my 10th first?
I haven't officially picked it. I penciled in. It's actually in pen, but I penciled
in. I penned mine in too, even though it's
I penciled in Rui Hachimura.
Okay.
but I'm getting cold feet.
I didn't pick him for my 10th spot.
I think he played about 1,200 minutes on a bat. And again, Terrence Davis played 1,100. So again, apples, oranges, pears, whatever, whatever we're comparing. That's a lot less minutes than some of the other guys. And his team was bad, so he doesn't have the good team sheen, that Davis has. But you know, I mean, you look at, I'm trying to find his stats here. I mean, 12 points.
He was like 13-6 or something, right?
13-6 a game. 48% overall, 51%. The one where he kind of lost me a little bit was 27% on threes. The jump shot isn't quite there yet, but beautiful mid-range game. You put a small guy on him and he goes to work. I like that. Defensively, he's sort of clueless like everybody else on that team for the most part. But yeah, you know, but every rookie other than Tybull and some of these other guys, a few other guys is pretty much clueless on defense. That's part of being a rookie. I actually I'm officially sort of vacating him from that spot. He may get it, but I'm less convinced the more I dug in. And I can tell you some other names later that I'm flirting with and thinking about, but I'm interested. You tell me your thought process on the last spot.
So, I don't know how you're going to feel about it. We've talked about him before. Actually, last time I was on your podcast, we talked about this person. I think the last podcast we did was, who are you looking at in the second half that you were really curious to see what they do? I went with Michael Porter Jr. in that podcast, and I'm actually going to go with him here.
And wow!
Basically, wow. The reason that I did that, because I, Hashimura was someone I considered, DeAndre Hunter was someone I considered, Jackson Hayes was someone I considered, along with Kobe White that we talked about. The reason I'm going with Porter, think back to what you just said about Matisse Thybulle a minute ago, where you said, you know, he didn't really get opportunities to do much and didn't, you know, when he wasn't playing, it was probably because of his offense, which is through no fault of his own. Well, maybe through some fault of his own. I kind of view Michael Porter Jr.'s situation as, I'm not completely convinced all the time that him not getting more playing time than he got was something that was his fault. Like, we obviously know he's not a complete player yet. But, you know, there were times where Denver would kind of stall a little bit on offense, and I couldn't understand why there were games where Michael Porter wasn't out there. And then when he did get to play, he kind of made an immediate difference. The other thing that I would say is a factor, easily one of the most efficient rookies in the league, easily, and not just efficient, but also really, really scoring and really, you know, creating his own shot in some situations a lot of the time, which I think was different fundamentally. Like, he could be out there and be the best offensive player out there for periods of time, which I think is a fundamental difference. Like, rookies aren't normally set up to be in that position to begin with. And that certainly was not the case with the other guys. Like, I looked at DeAndre Hunter and really wanted to give him my 10th spot. I looked at how he looked statistically when he wasn't on the floor with Trey. And that, again,
bad.
I think...
Bad. The answer is bad.
Yeah. And I mean, statistically, it was brutal. And that's my point is, like, you know, with Rui, I think it's kind of... Statistically, it wasn't as big of a drop-off when he wasn't out there with Beal. But the point is that Michael Porter could be your number one option while he was out there. Hell, even sometimes when he was out there with their other, you know, top rotation guys, you could kind of run what you were doing through him and just tell him to go to work and hit a crazy step back or something. So that's something where I'm like, I'm looking at how efficient he was despite the fact that he was often being relied upon to create his own stuff. And that was a fundamental difference between him and most of the guys on the all-rookie team, let alone the guys that I didn't slot in on my team. So I didn't expect to do that. I actually made up this list beforehand before I started looking at all the names and didn't even remember that he was someone I needed to be considering. But I would probably have him sneaking in for that 10th spot over Rui, over Hunter, over Jackson Hayes, over Kobe White.
You know what, Chris Herring? You know what? You may have me rethinking everything here. You may have just convinced me, because this is a spot for, I mean, you're talking about the last spot on second team all rookie. 5 minutes after this podcast, I will not remember the 10 names that I picked for second team all rookie. Without 2 weeks after I submit my ballot, I will not be able to recreate this part of my ballot. So we're talking about a footnote in history, a footnote underneath a footnote, attached to an end note or something. It might just be a place to say, you know what? I don't care that he played 670 minutes, which is like nothing. The dude is just good. You may have just convinced me. again, 670 minutes, but let me, some other things in his favor. You talked about his one-on-one work. I mean, like, that dude can ISO, face up, post, little guys. 54% on twos, 42% on threes. Whoa, boy. Guess who leads all rookies in rebounds per 36 minutes?
Michael Porter Jr. Wow. Michael Porter Jr. I did not know that.
It ain't Zion. It ain't Brandon Clark. It's not Jackson Hayes. It's Michael Porter Jr. He is a tenacious rebounder on both ends of the floor. It's actually in my 10 things that I've been meaning to include him. I mean, he has offensive rebounds where he's just straight jumping over guys and taking the ball from above their heads without making contact with them. He's just jumping up, getting above them and snatching the ball. And they're like, whoa, where'd this dude come from? Like, there are not many guys that get offensive rebounds that way.
Right.
I like this pick because you know what? These other guys I'm considering, it's like I'm holding my nose and eating food. I don't want to pick any of these guys. I don't want to pick Rui Hachimura. I don't want to pick DeAndre. I'm not going to pick DeAndre Hunter. I feel so much pity for RJ Barrett and like some admiration for the fact that on that team, he got to the line almost six times a game and he couldn't make any of them, but he got to the line six times a game.
That was part of the problem.
That he had a, you know, 3.5 assists per 36 minutes and only 2-something turnovers and bullied his way to 14 points a game. Like, there's a case to be made for him and the case that's not, for to be made for him is he shot, 43% on twos and 32% on threes and has one of the worst true shooting percentages.
He had the worst
in the league.
He had the worst effective field goal rate of anybody that I considered. I think I had like 23 guys on my list and he was worst. Reddish, who had a brutal first half of the season statistically, and actually similar to what we were saying about Kobe White, not to the same effect, but the last month and a half for him, the second half of the season, Cam Reddish went from 9 points a game and 47 true shooting percentage to 16.5 points per game and 62, 63 true shooting after the break. So he got better, but even with that end of the season run that he had, put him above RJ Barrett as far as his efficiency for the season. RJ, like you said, I appreciate that you're putting it in a better perspective and context.
The Knicks fans are going to be so mad.
If we Michael Carter Williams'd his way into the conversation, we could do it because statistically he had the numbers to do it, but he had the counting numbers to make the team. But
for me, he's definitely below the first nine that I had. And He's in my short list with Tybull and Hachimura and now Michael Porter Jr. because you've put him on my short list. And, you know, I gave a look to Hunter. I don't really buy it. I don't really buy it. Darius Garland has a lot of numbers, but they're mostly terrible. I don't really see, anyone else, you know, that merits a look here.
I looked a little bit at Cam Johnson. There were guys that had really nice statistics. They had good rookie seasons, but I'm not going to lose too much sleep over not having had them on the team. I feel like with Porter, when the more I thought about it, some part of it is like hindsight too, where like I feel like in a year or two when we're looking at Michael Porter and if he's like an all-star or something, does it ultimately matter who gets the 10th spot? Probably not that much, but like he has the most star potential still of any of these guys that we're talking about considering three spots, which does that matter? No, but like, I don't know that that was his fault that he wasn't getting more playing time and at least some playing time every night on that team, particularly when the Nuggets would go through dry spells offensively. So I don't know. I'm comfortable putting him there at 10. The other guys, I felt like there were things about their games I didn't like, and Porter seemed to improve on some of the things. I know the last time I was on your podcast, I was saying he basically was a plus, you know, in terms of plus minus, I think for something like 15 out of his last 18 appearances, which had gone way in the other direction, you know, from when he started where, you know, the defense and sometimes just the way he was controlling the ball was kind of throwing stuff off, it seemed like, in their offense. I don't know. I just felt like he made some strides with that team. It was a winning team, you know, fitting him in on a winning team. Maybe that's harder to do. I can live with that pick, especially as my 10th pick. I can live with that.
I like it, Chris Herring. I like it. You may have swayed me. Okay. So right now, my all rookie teams enter Zion Williamson, John Morant, Brandon Clark, Eric Paschal, Kendrick Nunn on the first team. Kobe White, Tyler Hero, PJ Washington, Terrence Davis, and maybe Michael Porter Jr. on the second team. Kind of like that.
So you were going to go with Rui before I argued the other way with
no, Porter? Rui already had a little like question mark next to him.
So you didn't have a final
placeholder for the 10th guy. This is actually this rookie class got a lot of hate early on in the season.
Not bad.
And the Hawks guys got off to just, oh my God, starts. Like legitimately, what have they done here? But then you remember, you just gotta be patient. These guys are so young. And we haven't even mentioned, like, I really liked Kevin Porter Jr. before he got hurt. Yeah. I thought he's a more interesting prospect, frankly, than Garland, who's frisky. No, I don't not like Darius Garland. I think he has potential. Jackson Hayes, as a dunker, role man guy we barely talked about.
Yep.
Cam Johnson can really shoot and moves his feet better than some of the skeptics I think made him out to be and was a decent rotation player for them. Mm-hmm. So Jarrett Culver we didn't talk about. I mean, he had stretches particularly toward the end of the season where he looked like he was finding his footing as a nice two-way wing for Minnesota. I don't know where they rank statistically and all that, but I'm weirdly kind of like this rookie class.
Like you were saying, you opened by saying this, that a lot of times you know, by the time you get to your seventh, eighth guys, it's kind of like, you know, picking a name out of a hat. There were a lot of people, I think, that, you know, that had pretty good rookie seasons that had, you know, even if they didn't have a great entire rookie season, a whole half of the season that they were just, you know, we just talked about Kobe White and other guys that kind of came on right at the end. Cam Reddish had a really nice second half. It makes it interesting to look at what happens next season and beyond that, because you've got a couple guys that project to be stars and have already kind of shown star power. But even if you don't have that, you've got some really solid starters in this class, I think.
And I guess we just disagree about Kobe White. A lock for me and not on the team for you.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'll hear it from the Chicago fans. Maybe they'll be too preoccupied to really – first of all, social distancing should mean nobody can come at me with pitchforks, at least not within 6 feet. But maybe the Jordan documentary will kind of keep them at bay well enough. But.
Well, and the NFL draft is today, so the Bears are, you know, all people care about really is the NFL. And so they're all going to be distracted by whoever the Bears are picking. All right, Chris Herring, you do outstanding work on the NBA and now COVID-19 for 538. thank you for taking time away from the virus beat to get back on the NBA beat. Love everything you write, and stay safe out there, okay?
I so appreciate you having me on, as always. You take care and stay safe, everybody.